Do not the things start on time, or in the case today, a little bit before scheduled time, and that senators do not overrun their allotted 10 minutes. We've heard from most of the Senate Judiciary Committee already. Left to go are Lindsey Graham on the Republican side, John Cornyn of Texas, Sam Brownback of Kansas, Tom Coburn of Oklahoma, Democrats Charles Schumer of New York, and Dick Durbin of Illinois. Of course, the Republicans outnumber Democrats on the committee 10-8. Nina Totenberg, John Roberts was initially nominated by the president to take an associate justice's seat, that of the retiring Associate Justice Sandra Day O'Connor. Of course, that was followed by the death of Chief Justice William Rehnquist. Less than 2 days later, the president asked John Roberts to be the nominee to be Chief Justice. Other than delaying the hearings for a week, how does that change things?
Well, politically, you could argue this round or flat. There are those who think that it makes, that the Democrats will, should, may give the nominee yet greater scrutiny because he's about to become the Chief Justice, only the 17th Chief Justice in our history. But on the other hand, Roberts is now taking the place of a conservative jurist. So it's a conservative for a conservative. He's not taking the place of the swing justice, Sandra Day O'Connor. And we don't know who that nominee will be yet, but everybody seems to think that if John Roberts does extremely well here, as I think most people expect, but if he does extremely well, that the real fight will be the next nominee who will be nominated to take Justice O'Connor's place.
Let me ask you a question about the timing of that. President Bush had said that he would, of course, like the Chief Justice to be in place on the first Monday in October when the Senate, when the Supreme Court session begins. The prospects of getting the second nominee to be vetted, confirmed by the committee, and qualified then by the confirmed by the United States Senate seem to be exceedingly dim. Would the president even nominate or be likely to nominate someone before this process is finished?
Well, he has indicated that at least he won't do that until John Roberts is through with his testimony before the committee and possibly through with his confirmation. In any event, it would be impossible, I think, to get a second nominee confirmed by the start of the term, in addition to the fact that Justice O'Connor, when she announced her retirement, made it effective upon the confirmation of a successor. So she can and will probably sit when the court opens on the first Monday.
Wouldn't that be a little strange to sit and hear cases that you're not going to be around to decide?
Well, it's not entirely clear whether she'll hear cases, but she certainly can vote on whether cases are to be granted in the future. There are all kinds of things that come to a justice. Death cases, base closing cases are appealed. Every day a justice gets last-minute appeals of one kind or another that he or she has to deal with, in addition to the fact that we don't really know when somebody's going to be confirmed. And it's entirely likely, if not possible, that she would sit on cases and vote in cases, and those in which a decision can be issued by the time when she is still sitting would then be issued. And if she's not there by the time the case is the decision is to be announced, let's say it's a 6-3, a 7-2, or a unanimous decision, they don't need her vote anyway. If they do need her vote, if it's 5-4, then they order it re-argued.
Just a little note, some housekeeping notes. We're in a 10-minute break, which is expected to be ending shortly, after which we will be hearing opening statements from the remaining members of the Senate Judiciary Committee, 10 minutes apiece. There will then be a somewhat longer break at 4 o'clock or so this afternoon Eastern Time. We're expecting Judge Roberts to make his opening statement. He will first be introduced. John Warner of Virginia will be presenting him. This is traditional that the senators from the nominee's home state, well, he lives in Maryland. There's no Democratic senator from Maryland. Nearest is Virginia, so John Warner of Virginia will be presenting him along with the two senators from the state of Indiana, which is, of course, his home state where he was born and raised. But, Nina, as we were saying at the beginning of this session today, John Roberts has lived in Washington, in and around Washington, D.C. now for a very long time.
It's also kind of interesting that Warner is doing this introduction. Not only is he one of the senior members of the Senate now and the chairman of the Armed Services Committee, he is he was a law clerk to a very famous appeals court judge in Washington, D.C., Barrett Prettyman. In fact, the courthouse here, the federal courthouse, is named the Barrett Prettyman Courthouse. And John Roberts went to work at the law firm of Hogan and Hartson when he left the government and worked for a fellow by the name of Barrett Prettyman, who is the son of the judge. And so there's a long connection to the local federal court of appeals. Barrett Prettyman II, who is still with us, is a very fine lawyer and led the practice, the appellate practice at the law firm of Hogan and Hartson, is a Democrat. And interestingly, John Warner voted against Robert Bork. He was one of the six, if memory serves me, Republicans who voted against Robert Bork. And he did so in his speech. I remember that he did so saying that his boss, the guy he had learned about the law from the most, Barrett Prettyman, the late Judge Barrett Prettyman, I think it's E. Barrett Prettyman, would have, that this was not, the Bork philosophy was not his idea of what a judge was supposed to do, that it was too ideological, that it was, and that that was the reason he was voting against Bork. So here he is now nominating, giving the introduction for John Roberts, and I think that says it all.
Tom Goldstein, as we listen to some of these Republican senators advising the nominee on which questions to answer and which ones he should be perfectly happy to decline to answer, is the name Robert Bork in their memory somehow, do you think?
Oh, I do. I think that in this building and in this rotunda and in that room, you hear the echoes of the Robert Bork confirmation process through the decades. It is something that is etched into the memories, particularly of Republicans, as really the time that the confirmation process went sour. And they believe that the Senate really unjustly interfered in the president's prerogative to nominate and get his person on the Supreme Court. By contrast, Democrats really believe that it was the epitome of what the Senate is supposed to be doing, and that is preventing someone whose views are too extreme from getting onto the Supreme Court.
We're in a 10-minute break as the Senate Judiciary Committee continues its consideration of the nomination of John Roberts to be Chief Justice of the United States. I'm Neil Conan, alongside NPR Legal Affairs correspondent Nina Totenberg and analyst Tom Goldstein. We're rating the return of the committee, and you mentioned John Warner as one of the six Republicans who voted against the nomination of Robert Bork. Another one of them is Arlen Specter, now the chairman of the Senate Judiciary Committee.
Yeah, when you look at this committee, it's got an interesting background. First of all, most of the members of the committee have never been through this before. Secondly, one of the members of the committee, Jeff Sessions of Alabama, at one point was nominated by President Reagan to be a federal district court judge in Alabama, and he was voted down in committee, and one of the folks who voted against him is the now chairman, Arlen Specter, who says through gritted teeth that it was a mistake, and Jeff Sessions had the ultimate revenge of being elected subsequently to the United States Senate and sitting on a committee with a lot of the people that voted against him and being a thorn in their sides.
I misspoke earlier. Judge Roberts was born in Buffalo, New York, and raised in Indiana, so nevertheless considers Indiana his home. Senator Specter is back in the chairman's chair, and looking around imperiously, waiting for his colleagues to return to their seats. And now Judge Roberts is taking his seat at the witness table, and we're about to resume this session. Next to be addressing the senator in an opening statement will be Lindsey Graham of South Carolina, Republican. Is a name that may be familiar for those of you who remember the impeachment hearings. He was, of course, a member of the House Judiciary Committee at that time, and one of the people who presented the prosecution of President Clinton. And now let's listen to Senator Graham.
Senators proves the fact it's not going to be easy. But I hope that we will live up to our end of the bargain to make it fair. And fair is something that comes around in September in South Carolina, or it can be an idea. The idea of treating you fairly is very important to me, because not only are you on display, but the Senate's on display. And Senator Kennedy said something that I disagree with, but he's very passionate in his statement. He said the central issue is whether or not you will embrace policies, certain set of policies, or whether or not you will roll back certain policy decisions. I respectfully disagree with Senator Kennedy. To me, the central issue before the Senate is whether or not the Senate will allow President Bush to fulfill his campaign promise to appoint a well-qualified strict constructionist to the Supreme Court, and in this case, to appoint a Chief Justice to the Supreme Court in the mold of Justice Rehnquist. He's been elected president twice. He has not hidden from the public what his view of a Supreme Court justice should be and the philosophy that they should embrace. In my opinion, by picking you, he has lived up to his end of the bargain with the American people by choosing a well-qualified strict constructionist. You have been described as brilliant, talented, and well-qualified, and that's by Democrats. The question is that enough in 2005 to get confirmed? Maybe not. Professor Michael Gerhardt has written an article in 2000 called The Federal Appointments Process, and I think he has given some advice to our Democratic friends in the past and maybe recently about the confirmation process that we're engaged in today. And he has written, the Constitution establishes a presumption of confirmation that works to the advantage of the president and his nominee. I agree with that. Elections matter. We're not here to debate how to solve all the nation's problems. We're not here to talk about liberal philosophy versus conservative philosophy and what's best for the country. We're here to talk about you and whether or not you are qualified to sit on the Supreme Court, whether or not you have the intellect, the integrity, and the character. And it has been said in the past by members of this committee, Senator Kennedy, I believe it's recognized by most senators that we're not charged with the responsibility of approving justices if their views always coincide with our own. We're really interested in knowing whether the nominee has the background, experience, qualifications, temperament, integrity to handle the most sensitive, important, and responsible job, and that's being on the Supreme Court. If you're looking for consistency, you probably come to the wrong place. Because the truth of the matter is that we're all involved in the electoral process ourselves, and we have different agendas. Your memos are going to be talked about. The memos you wrote while you were working for President Reagan and Bush 1, in my opinion, reflect a conservative lawyer advising a conservative president about conservative policies. And to some, those policies make no sense. Those policies are out of the mainstream, but this hearing is about whether or not you're qualified and whether or not Reagan conservatism is in the mainstream. Is affirmative action requires quotas? From a conservative point of view, no. From a conservative point of view, we don't want federal judges setting the value of someone's wages from the bench, and you wrote about that. Now, some people want that, but conservatives don't. Environmental policies. We want a clean environment. We don't want to ruin the economy in the process. We want to be able to build levees to protect cities. Conservatives have a different view of a lot of issues versus our friends on the other side. The election determines how that shakes out. We're here to determine whether or not you and all you've done in your life makes you a fitting candidate to be on the Supreme Court. Before we got here, the Senate was in disarray. May 23rd of this year, I engaged in a compromise agreement with 7 Democrats and 7 Republicans to keep the Senate from blowing itself up. You're the first nomination that we've dealt with in any significant manner after that agreement. There's plenty of blame to go around, Judge Roberts. On our watch, I'm sure we did things in committee that were very unfair to Democratic nominees, particularly by President Clinton. And at the time of that agreement, there were 10 people being filibustered for the first time in the history of the Senate in a partisan manner that were going to be on the Court of Appeals. We were in chaos. We were at each other's throats. And since May 23rd, we've done better. The Senate has gotten back to a more traditional role when it comes to judges. And as Senator Spector described the committee, we've done some good things here on this committee and the Senate as a whole. I hope we will take the chance to start over because the public approval of the Senate now is in the 30s. And that's not your fault, Judge Roberts. It's our fault. We have an opportunity as senators to show that we can disagree based on philosophy but give you a fair shake. The question is whether we'll rise to the occasion. I'm hopeful we will based on the statements being made. What is the standard for a senator to confirm a Supreme Court nominee? Whatever the senator wants it to be. And really, that's the way it should be. But there should be some goals, in my opinion. The way we conduct ourselves, one of the goals we should have is to make sure we don't run good people away from wanting to be a judge. I don't know what it's like to sit at home and turn on the television and watch a commercial about you in the presence of your wife and your kids that say some pretty unflattering things about you. That's just not a problem you faced. I'm sure Democratic nominees have faced the same type problem. We shouldn't, in our standard, trying to come up with a standard, invalidate election. The president won. The president told us what he's going to do, and he did it. He picked a strict constructionist to be on the Supreme Court. If anybody's surprised, they weren't listening to the last campaign. Roe v. Wade. It divides America. If you believe in polling, most Americans would like to see the decision stand, even though we're divided 50-50 on the idea of abortion on demand. My good friend from California has expressed a view about Roe v. Wade, which I completely understand and respect. I can just tell you, Judge Roberts, there are plenty of women in South Carolina who have an opposite view about abortion. If we were to make our votes, base our votes on that one principle, Justice Ginsburg would not be Justice Ginsburg. In her writing, she embraced the idea of federal funding for abortion. She indicated that an abortion right was based on the Equal Protection Clause of the Constitution. I dare say that 90% of the Republican caucus is pro-life. I dare say that 90% of the Democratic caucus is pro-choice. Justice Ginsburg got 96 votes, even though she expressed a view of the federal government's role in abortion that I completely disagree with, and I think most conservatives disagree with. There was a time, not too long ago, Judge Roberts, where it was about the way you lived your life, how you conducted yourself, what kind of lawyer you were, what kind of man or woman you were, not whether you had an allegiance to a specific case or a particular cause. Let's get back to those days. Let's get back to the days where the Ginsburgs and the Scalias can be pushed and pressed, but they can be honored for their commitment to the law and the way they lived their life. Let's get back to the good old days where we understood that what we were looking for was well-qualified people to sit on the highest court of the land, not political clones of our own philosophy. The reason I signed the agreement more than anything else was that I loved the law. The role of the law in our society is so important. You take out the rule of law and you don't have a democracy. The law, Judge Roberts, to me, represents a quiet place in American discourse. Politics is a loud, noisy, and destructive place. But the courtroom is a quiet place where the weak can challenge the strong and the unpopular can be heard. I know you will honor the rule of law in our country, and that you will be a judge that we all can be proud of. God bless you and your family.
Opening statements will continue. Next, we will hear from Democrat Charles Schumer of New York.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Judge Roberts, welcome to you and Mrs. Roberts, your parents, your family, your two beautiful children. I join my colleagues in congratulating you on your nomination to the position of Chief Justice of the United States. Now, this is indisputably the rarest opportunity in American government. In the entire history of the Republic, we have had but 16 Chief Justices. But the responsibility is as great as the opportunity is rare. The decisions of the Supreme Court have a fundamental impact on people's lives, and the influence of a Chief Justice far outlasts that of a president. As the youngest nominee to the High Court's top seat in 204 years, you have the potential to wield more influence over the lives of the citizens of this country than any jurist in history. I cannot think of a more awesome responsibility. Awesome not in the way my teenage daughter would use the word, but in the biblical sense of the angels trembling in the presence of God. But before you can assume that responsibility, we senators, on behalf of the people, have to exercise our own responsibility. Fundamental to that responsibility is our obligation to ascertain your legal philosophy and judicial ideology. To me, the pivotal question which will determine my vote is this: are you within the mainstream, albeit the conservative mainstream, or are you an ideologue who will seek to use the court to impose your views upon us, as certain judges, past and present, on the left and on the right, have attempted to do? The American people need to learn a lot more about you before they and we can answer that question. You are without question an impressive, accomplished, and brilliant lawyer. You're a decent and honorable man. You have a remarkable resume. There are those who say your outstanding and accomplished resume should be enough, that you should simply promise to be fair, and that we should confirm. I disagree. To me, the most important function of these hearings, because it's the most important qualification for a nominee to the Supreme Court, is to understand your legal philosophy and judicial ideology. This is especially true now that judges are largely nominated through an ideological prism by a president who has admitted he wants to appoint justices in the mold of Scalia and Thomas. To those who say ideology doesn't matter, they should take their quarrel to President Bush. I began to argue that a nominee's judicial ideology was crucial 4 years ago. Then I was almost alone. Today, there is a growing and gathering consensus on the left and on the right that these questions are legitimate, important, and awful crucial. Therefore, I and others on both sides of the aisle will ask you about your views. Here's what the American people need to know beyond your resume. They need to know who you are and how you think. They need to assess not only the sharpness of your mind, but the fullness of your heart. They need to believe that an overachiever can identify with an underdog who has nothing but the Constitution on his side. They need to understand that your first-class education and your advantaged life will not blind you to the plight of those who need help and who rely on the protections of the Constitution, which is every one of us at one point or another. They need to be confident that your claim of judicial modesty is more than easy rhetoric, that your praise of legal stability is more than lip service. They need to know, above all, that if you take the stewardship of the high court, you will not steer it so far out of the mainstream that it founders in the shallow waters of extremist ideology. As far as your own views go, however, we only have scratched the surface. In a sense, we have seen maybe 10% of you, just the visible tip of the iceberg, not the 90% that is still submerged. And we all know that it is the ice beneath the surface that can sink the ship. For this reason, it is our obligation to ask and your obligation to answer questions about your judicial philosophy and legal ideology. If you can't answer these questions, how are we to determine whether you're in the mainstream? A simple resume, no matter how distinguished, cannot answer that question. So for me, the first criterion upon which I will base my vote is whether you will answer questions fully and forthrightly. We do not want to trick you, badger you, or play a game of gotcha. That is why I met with you privately 3 times, and that's why I gave you a list of questions in advance of these hearings. It's not enough to say you will be fair. If that were enough, we'd have no need for a hearing. I have no doubt you believe you'll be a fair judge. I have no doubt that Justice Scalia thinks he is a fair judge, and that Justice Ginsburg thinks she is a fair judge. But in case after case, they rule differently. They approach the Constitution differently. And they affect the lives of 280 million Americans differently. That is so, even though both Scalia and Ginsburg believe that they are fair. You should be prepared to explain your views of the First Amendment and civil rights and environmental rights, religious liberty, privacy, workers' rights, women's rights, and a host of other issues relevant to the most powerful lifetime post in the nation. Now, having established that ideology and judicial philosophy are important, what's the best way to go about questioning on these subjects? The best way, I believe, is through understanding your views about particular past cases, not future cases that haven't been decided, but past, already decided cases. It's not the only way, but it's the best and most straightforward way. Some have argued that questioning a nominee about his or her personal views of the Constitution or about decided cases indicates prejudgment about a future case. It does nothing of the sort. Most nominees who have come before us, including Justice Ginsburg, whose precedents you often cite, have answered such questions. Contrary to popular mythology, when she was a nominee, Justice Ginsburg gave lengthy answers to scores of questions about constitutional law and decided cases, including individual autonomy, the First Amendment, criminal law, choice, discrimination, and gender equality. Although there were places she said she did not want to answer, she spoke about dozens of Supreme Court cases and often gave her unvarnished impressions, suggesting that some were problematic in their reasoning, while others were eloquent in their vindication of important constitutional principles. And nominee after nominee, from Powell to Thomas to Breyer, answered numerous questions about decided cases, and no one ever questioned their fitness to hear cases on issues raised during confirmation hearings. So I hope you'll decide to answer questions about decided cases, which so many other nominees have done. If you refuse to talk about already decided cases, the burden, sir, is on you, one of the most preeminent litigators in America, to figure out a way in plain English to help us determine whether you'll be a conservative but mainstream conservative Chief Justice or an ideologue. Let me be clear. I know you're a conservative. I don't expect your views to mirror mine. After all, President Bush won the election, and everyone understands that he will nominate conservatives to the court. But while we certainly do not expect the court to move to the left under the president, it should not move radically to the right. You told me when we met that you are not an ideologue and you share my aversion to ideologues. Yet, you've been embraced by some of the most extreme ideologues in America, like the leader of Operation Rescue. That gives rise to a question many are asking. What do they know that we don't? Judge Roberts, if you want my vote, you need to meet two criteria. First, you need to answer questions fully so we can ascertain your judicial philosophy. And second, once we have ascertained your philosophy, it must be clear that it is in the broad mainstream. Judge Roberts, if you answer important questions forthrightly and convince me you're a jurist in the broad mainstream, I'll be able to vote for you. And I would like to be able to vote for you. But if you do not, I will not be able to vote for you. Mr. Chairman, I have high hopes for these hearings. I want and the American people want a dignified, respectful hearing process, open, fair, thorough, above board, one that not only brings dignity, but even more importantly, information about Judge Roberts' views and ideology to the American people. I, along with all of America, look forward to hearing your testimony.
Thank you, Senator Schumer.
And
Senator
next, Cornyn. We'll go back to the Republican side of the Senate Judiciary Committee for John Cornyn of Texas.
Extending a warm welcome to you and your family for these hearings. As the 15th speaker in the order of seniority here, I recall the adage I learned when I first came to Washington that everything's been said, but not everyone has said it yet. And perhaps by the time this hearing is over this week, you will have a fuller appreciation than you do now for that. But, of course, you are a known quantity, so to speak, to this committee and to this Senate, having been confirmed by unanimous consent just 2 short years ago. And I want to extend a compliment to you on your judicial service. You have served with distinction in your current capacity. While the importance of your nomination as Chief Justice of the United States cannot be overstated, it seems as though each new nomination to the court brings an element of drama somewhat akin to an election. Indeed, we've seen special interest groups raising money, running television advertisements, and even trying to coerce you into stating your opinion on hot-button issues that are likely to come before you as a judge as if this were an election. But, of course, this is not an election, and no reasonable person expects you to make promises to politicians about how you're likely to rule on those issues when they come before the court as a condition of confirmation. Still, some in our country have lost sight of the proper role of an unelected judge, where the people are sovereign, and where government enjoys no legitimacy except by consent of the governed. They see unelected judges as primarily as policymakers and arbiters of every pressing social issue that might arise, with the authority to dictate to the people what they think is good for us. Well, this ideal of the Supreme Court as a super legislature to which we might turn to give us everything that is good and stop everything that is bad is not a view that I share, nor for that matter did those who wrote and ratified the Constitution. The Constitution does not guarantee everything that is good and prohibit everything that is bad, or it could have been written in 2 sentences. Rather, it guarantees some specific things, it prohibits some specific things, and leaves the rest to be sorted out through the democratic process. Alexander Hamilton, as you know, wrote in the Federalist Papers, which argued for ratification of the Constitution, that the judicial branch he predicted would be known as the least dangerous branch. He believed that there is no liberty if the power of judging is not separated from the legislative and executive powers. Its sole purpose was to interpret and apply the laws of the land. Its role would be limited. Regrettably, justices have not always been faithful to this constitutional design. All we need to do is to look at the Supreme Court's track record to see why abdicating our right of self-government to 9 judges isolated behind a monumental marble edifice, far removed from the life experiences of the average American, is a bad idea. For example, the Constitution says in part that the federal government shall not prohibit the free exercise of religion or abridge freedom of speech. Many Americans, including me, are concerned that the Supreme Court, by erecting extra constitutional and contradictory judge-made standards in this area of the law, has effectively banned voluntary religious expression from much of our public life, turning what should be official neutrality into a policy of official hostility. To be sure, the court has been zealous in protecting the rights of those who express themselves or promote their products using violence or sex. But voluntary expression of one's faith? Never. Likewise, many Americans, including me, are baffled that the Supreme Court recently saw fit to strike down the display of the Ten Commandments in Kentucky, but uphold the constitutionality of a display in Texas, even while the Ten Commandments itself is prominently displayed in the chambers of the United States Supreme Court on its ceiling. Many Americans, including me, wondered what to read into the court's recent dismissal of a suit seeking to deny school children the right to recite the Pledge of Allegiance because it contains the words, "One Nation Under God." A majority of the court refused to agree that the pledge was constitutional, leaving this time-honored tradition of school children across our nation in legal limbo. And recently, the court expanded the awesome power of government to condemn private property beyond all previous bounds by reading the public use limitation on eminent domain right out of the Constitution. Justice O'Connor warned, "The specter of condemnation now hangs over all property. Nothing is to prevent the state from replacing any Motel 6 with a Ritz-Carlton. any home with a shopping mall, or any farm with a factory. On what legitimate basis can the Supreme Court uphold state laws on the death penalty in 1989, then strike them down in 2005, relying not on the written Constitution, which, of course, had not changed, but on foreign laws that no American has voted on, consented to, or may even be aware of? When in 2003 the court decided Lawrence versus Texas, the court overruled a 1986 decision on the constitutionality of state laws based on the collective moral judgment of those states about permissible sexual activity. What changed in that intervening time? Did the Constitution change? Well, no. Did the justices change? Yes. But should that determine a different meaning of the Constitution? Are some judges merely imposing their personal preferences under the guise of constitutional interpretation? Indeed, this was the same case, as you know, Judge Roberts, that served as the cornerstone of the Massachusetts Supreme Court's decision holding that state laws limiting marriage to a man and a woman amounted to illegal discrimination. Let me close on an issue that several senators have already mentioned today, and that is your obligation to answer our questions. Of course, I share with all of my colleagues a desire to, and a curiosity, really, to know what you think about all sorts of issues. All of us are curious. But just because we're curious doesn't mean that our curiosity should be satisfied. You have no obligation to tell us how you will rule on any issue that might come before you if you're confirmed to the Supreme Court. It boils down to a question of impartiality and fairness. One characteristic of a good judge is that they keep an open mind until they hear that the future cases possibly feel that they would ever have a fair day in court. Justice Ginsburg, as we've heard already, one of the last Supreme Court justices confirmed by the Senate, noted not too long ago, in accord with longstanding norm, every member of the current Supreme Court declined to furnish such information. The line each justice drew in response to pre-confirmation questioning is crucial to the health of the federal judiciary. And this has come to be known as the Ginsburg standard, although it has been the norm for all nominees who come before the committee and before the Senate for confirmation. Now, I know some of the members of the committee will ask you questions that you can't answer. They'll try to entice you to abandon the rules of ethics and the long tradition described by Justice Ginsburg. But that should not concern you, Judge Roberts. Don't take the bait. Do not head down that road, but do exactly what every nominee of every Republican president and every Democrat president has done. Decline to answer any question that you feel would compromise your ability to do your job. The vast majority of the Senate, I am convinced, will not punish you for doing so. Rather, I'm convinced that the vast majority of the Senate will respect you for this decision because it will show you are a person of deep integrity and independence, unwilling to trade your ethics for a confirmation vote. Again, let me say welcome to you again before the committee, and thank you for your continued willingness to serve this great nation.
Thank you, Senator Cornyn. Senator Durbin.
And we'll next hear from the junior Democrat on the Senate Judiciary Committee. This is Richard Durbin of Illinois.
Congratulations on your nomination. The committee hearing began with the chairman telling us that you had shared the wisdom of 47 individual senators by visiting their office, some of them on several different occasions. And many people believe that that fact alone should earn you confirmation before the United States Senate. 12 years ago, at the nomination hearing of Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg, my friend, Illinois Senator Paul Simon, said something worth repeating. He said to the nominee, and I quote, "You face a much harsher judge than this committee. That's the judgment of history. And that judgment is likely to revolve around one question. Did you restrict freedom or did you expand it?" I think Senator Simon put his finger on how the United States Senate should evaluate a nominee for a lifetime appointment to the federal bench. Judge Roberts, if you're confirmed to be the first Supreme Court justice in the 21st century, The basic question is this: will you restrict the personal freedoms we enjoy as Americans, or will you expand them? When we met in my office many weeks ago, I gave you a biography of a judge I admire greatly. His name was Frank Johnson, a federal district judge from Alabama and a lifelong Republican. 50 years ago, following the arrest of Rosa Parks, Judge Johnson ruled that African Americans in Montgomery, Alabama, were acting within their constitutional rights when they organized a boycott of the buses, and that Martin Luther King Jr. and others could march from Selma to Montgomery. As a result of those decisions, the Ku Klux Klan branded Johnson the most hated man in America. Wooden crosses were burned on his lawn. He received so many death threats that his family was under constant federal protection from 1961 to 1975. Judge Frank Johnson was denounced as a judicial activist and threatened with impeachment. He had the courage to expand freedom in America. Judge Roberts, I hope that you agree America must never return to those days of discrimination and limitations on our freedom. Now, some of the memos you wrote that I talked to you about in my office many, many years ago in the Reagan administration have raised some serious concerns about where you stand on civil rights and women's rights, concerns that have led some of the most respected civil rights groups in America to openly oppose your nomination. So it's important for you at this hearing to answer the questions and to tell us your views on civil rights and equality and the role of courts in protecting these basic freedoms. This hearing is your opportunity to clarify the record, to explain your views. We can't assume that time or maturity has changed your thinking from those Reagan-era memos. The refusal of the White House to disclose documents on 16 specific cases you wrote as Deputy Solicitor General deny this committee more contemporary expressions of your values. Only your testimony before this committee can convince us that John Roberts of 2005 will be a truly impartial and open-minded Chief Justice. Concerns have also been raised about some of the things you wrote relative to the right of privacy. We've gone through Griswold. We know what that Supreme Court decision meant in 1965, 40 years ago, when the court struck down the Connecticut statute, which made it a crime for married couples to buy and use birth control. They said there was a fundamental right of privacy in that Constitution, though you can search every word of it and not find the word privacy. But it's far from settled law in the minds of many. 40 years later, there have been new efforts to restrict the right of privacy, attempts to impose gag rules on doctors when they speak to their patients about family planning. You saw it in the sad debate over the tragedy of Terri Schiavo, a debate that led some members of Congress to threaten judges who disagreed with their point of view with impeachment. And you can find it in the eagerness to authorize the government to pry into our financial records, medical records, and library records. Whether the court continues to recognize and protect America's right to privacy will have a profound impact on every American from birth to death. In your early writings that we have to rely on here, you referred to this right of privacy as an abstraction. We need to know if that's what you believe. We also need to hear your views on another basic issue, and that is the view on executive power. They don't teach this subject much in law school. It's not tested on any bar exam, but it's not been a major focus in many Supreme Court hearings. Yet it's very important today. Some aspects of your record, your early record when you were an attorney for a president, suggest you might be overly deferential to the executive branch. We need to know where you stand. Throughout history, during times of war, presidents have tried to restrict liberty in the name of security. The Supreme Court has always been the guardian of our Constitution. It's usually been up to the task, but sometimes it's failed, such as in the notorious Korematsu decision. We're being tested again. Will we stand by our Constitution in this age of terrorism? That challenge will fall especially on our Supreme Court and on you, Judge Roberts, if you're confirmed. We also need to know what you think about religious liberty. Over the past few decades, the Supreme Court has maintained a delicate yet what I believe proper balance between church and state. Justice Sandra Day O'Connor said it so well in the recent Ten Commandments decision, and I quote, "At a time when we see around the world the violent consequences of the assumption of religious authority by government, Americans may count themselves fortunate. Our regard for constitutional boundaries has protected us from similar travails while allowing private religious exercise to flourish. Those who would renegotiate the boundaries between church and state must answer a difficult question. Why would we trade a system that has served us so well for one that has served others so poorly? I asked you a question when you came by to see me, which I'm not sure either one of us could answer at that moment. I asked you, who has the burden of proof at this hearing? Do you have the burden to prove that you are a person worthy of a lifetime appointment before the Supreme Court? Or do we have the burden to prove that President Bush was wrong in selecting you? Your position as Supreme Court Justice, Chief Justice, gives you extraordinary power to appoint 11 judges on the FISA court, which has the authority to issue warrants for search and wiretaps of American citizens, all the way to the establishment of rules of criminal and civil procedure. No one has the right to sit on that court. No one has the right to be Chief Justice. But they can earn it through a hearing such as the one which we have today. I'd like to say that I spoke earlier about the courage of Frank Johnson. A few months ago, another judge of rare courage testified before this committee. Her name is Joan Lefkoe. She's a federal judge in Chicago, and I was honored to nominate her. Last February, her husband and mother were murdered in her home by a deranged man who was angry that she had dismissed his lawsuit. In her remarks to the committee, Judge Lefkoe said that the murders of her family members were, quote, a direct result of a decision made in the course of fulfilling our duty to do justice without fear or favor. In my view, that is the only proper test for a Supreme Court justice. Will he do justice without fear or favor? Will he expand freedom for all Americans, as Judge Frank Johnson, the condemned judicial activist, once did? I congratulate you, Judge Roberts, on your nomination, your accomplished career, and I look forward to these hearings to give you your chance in the next several days not to rely on 20-year-old memos or innuendos and statements by those who are not part of the hearing, but in your own words, a chance to tell us and to tell the American people what you truly believe. If you believe that you have the burden at this hearing to establish why you are worthy of this, the highest-ranking position of a judge in America, I hope that you will be forthcoming. If you do not answer the questions, if you hold back, if you believe, as some on the other side have suggested, that you have no responsibility to answer these questions, I'm afraid that the results will not be as positive. I certainly hope that they will be positive. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Durbin.
And we'll now go back to the Republican side of the Senate Judiciary Committee for two more questioners. We'll start with Sam Brownback, Republican of Kansas.
And this is certainly a long way to spend it. It's seeming like a long birthday. Thank you. Judge Roberts, as one of my colleagues just saying, I hope we're done before my birthday ends. I welcome you to the court. Delighted to have you here, you and your family. Want to congratulate you on your lifetime of service thus far and looking forward to future service that you'll have for this great land. I recall the meeting that you and I had in my office, as many of the members here have as well, and enjoyed them. You said two things in there that I particularly took away and hung on as an indicator of yourself and how you would look at the courts and also what America needed from our courts. One of the statements was that we need a more modest court. And I looked at that and I thought about it and I thought that's exactly, I think, the way the American people would look at the situation today. We need a more modest court, a court that's a court but not a super legislature, as you've heard others refer to, or is in a different role but is a court. And that's what it needs to be, and that's what we need to have, one that looks at the Constitution as it is, not as we wish it might be, but as it is, so that we can be a nation that's a rule of law nation. You had a second point that was very apt, I thought, when you talked about the courts in baseball. You drew the analogy of those two together, which was apt, I thought, and you said it's a bad thing when the umpire is the most watched person on the field. And I guess that appealed to me as well from the standpoint that where we are in today's American governance, where the legislature can pass the bill, the executive can sign it, but everybody waits and holds their breath until how the court's going to look at this and how it's going to interpret it, because it seems as if the court is the real mover of what the actual law is. And that's a bad thing. The umpire should call the ball fair or foul. It's in or it's out, but not get actively involved as a player on the field. And unfortunately, we've gotten to a point today where, in many respects, the judiciary is the most active policy player on the field. I was struck by your nomination and what you said when you were nominated, that you, quote, had a profound appreciation for the role of the court in our constitutional democracy. And that's something I think we all respect and we look for in what we need to do. Democracy, I believe, loses its luster when justices on the high court, who are unelected and not directly accountable, invent constitutional rights and alter the balance of governmental powers in ways that find no support in the text, the structure, or the history of the Constitution. Unfortunately, the court in recent years, I believe, has gone into that terrain. In our system of government, the Constitution contemplates that federal courts will exercise limited jurisdiction. They should neither write nor execute the laws, but simply say what the law is, in quoting Marbury versus Madison. The narrow scope of judicial power was the reason the people accepted the idea that the federal courts could have the power of judicial review, that is, the ability to decide whether a challenged law comports with the Constitution. The people believed that the courts would maintain their independence and, at the same time, would recognize their role by deferring to the political branches on policy choices. Legitimacy based on judicial restraint was a concept perhaps best expressed by Justice Felix Frankfurter, appointed by President Franklin Delano Roosevelt. He said this: courts are not representative bodies. They are not designed to be a good reflex of a democratic society. Their judgment is best informed and therefore most dependable within narrow limits. Their essential quality is detachment founded on independence. And history teaches that the independence of the judiciary is jeopardized when courts become embroiled in the passions of the day and assume primary responsibility in choosing between competing political, economic, and social pressures. Primary responsibility for adjusting the interests which compete of necessity belongs to the Congress. Yet courts today have strayed far beyond this limited role. Constitutionalists from Hamilton to Frankfurter surely would be shocked at the broad sweep of judicial activity today. Just listen to some of them. Federal courts are redefining the meaning of marriage, deciding when a human life is worthy of protection, running prisons and schools by decree, removing expressions of faith in the public square, permitting the government under the Takings Clause to confiscate property from one person and give it to another in the name of private economic development, and then interpreting our American Constitution on the basis of foreign and international law. Perhaps the Supreme Court's most notorious exercise of raw political power came in Roe versus Wade and Doe v. Bolton. Two 1973 cases based on false statements